Hi, everyone. This is Liam Deckel with the Student Screenwriting Podcast. Today, we're here with David Balkin, professor of the practice of cinematic arts at USC, teaching screenwriting. He's a writer, producer of over 250 hours of film. He was also a showrunner on 5 television shows. Hi, David. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, it's my pleasure. How are you, Liam?
I'm great. So let's dive right in. At what age did you get into writing and film, and what made you do so?
Well, I think I was always a storyteller, not necessarily a writer, but I lived a very active and colorful fantasy life, even as a little boy. I mean, I would organize plays and we would play different games. And of course, I was always the hero and always saved the best roles for me. But as I got older and became more and more interested in really the art and the craft of storytelling, I think it really started to evolve for me during the latter part of my college years at the University of Connecticut.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask, well, what did you study there at UConn?
I majored in English literature, specializing in fiction of writers of the 20th century. And the reason that I chose that, frankly, honestly, is because I knew that I was going to have to do a lot of reading if I was majoring in political science or sociology or one of the other practices. And I thought, as long as I'm going to be doing reading, yeah, I'd like to read novels. I'd like to read stories. I'd like to read things that truly interested me.
Do you think if you studied screenwriting in college, it would have helped you more in your career?
You know, I was so naive back then, and it was a very, very different time. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know that there was a concept called film schools. And the idea of studying screenplays and studying writing was something that I didn't really think out that much. I just knew that I had this great passion mm-hmm. for make-believe, really. And I think that for me personally, that was something that was very therapeutic. I'm post-polio. And because of that, I was somewhat limited in what I could do in terms of physical activities. Yeah. So much of my energy came to creating stories. And initially, really what I wanted to be was an actor, because I'm an unabashed show off. But as I got further and further into the realities of the business, I realized that because of my physical disability, I wouldn't get cast in the roles that I wanted to. Yeah. So I started to write. And that way I could be any and all characters. I could be protagonist, I could be antagonist, I could be male, I could be female, I could be the sidekick, I could be the hero. And that's really how it began for me.
Mm-hmm. So do you think if you went to college now, you would choose screenwriting as a major?
Yes, I would. I would certainly concentrate on film. As it was when I graduated from UConn, I had a double minor. One was in English, as I already mentioned, and the other was in speech and drama.
Mm-hmm. So after leaving university, what did you go on to next?
Well, I lived in Connecticut, and I wasn't really ready to make the trip to California.
Yeah.
I really didn't know anybody out here. I didn't have any promise of a job. I didn't have any connections that were viable. So I went to New York and I pounded the streets, and I ultimately got a job working for CBS in New York City, working in television network news. And at that time I thought, well, maybe TV journalism is the answer for me. And I wound up becoming one of the many assistants for Walter Cronkite, who at that time was the dean of television journalists. Wow. And that was a very heady and a wonderful experience, because I got to be present in the newsroom when these international and national stories were breaking.
Yeah.
But for a lot of reasons, I just felt that ultimately that wasn't the direction I wanted to go in. A dear friend of mine was climbing the ladder of success in the world of advertising, mm-hmm. which was the New York City was the Mecca, and probably yeah. still is, of advertising agencies. And because of him, I got involved in writing spec ads. And ultimately, I got a job working for one of the premier advertising agencies on Wall Street, not on Wall Street, on Madison Avenue.
Mm-hmm. So how did you make that switch then from advertising to writing?
Well, I had this epiphany, Liam. I'm going to be very candid with you and with our audience. I was working on an account, I believe it was Heinz Ketchup. And that was a big account. And I was in a marketing meeting. And I was listening to this marketing manager talking about how many cases of Heinz Ketchup they had sold in the Cleveland, Ohio area. And I kept writing on a legal pad with my trusty ballpoint pen. Who cares? Who cares? Who cares? Who cares? And it was a message to me that it was time for me to either suck it up and do something that my heart really wasn't into, or make the final push. Mm-hmm. And then what I started to do was this was before you could download shows. Yeah. So I had a tape recorder and I would tape the monologues of Johnny Carson, who was the longtime host of The Tonight yeah. Show. And then I would transcribe them to paper. And I would look not just at the jokes, not just at the setup and the punchline, but at the meter, the rhythm. And I started writing spec jokes. Mm-hmm. And I sent them in to an agent at the William Morris Agency, who responded very positively. And essentially, he was in New York, and essentially he said, go west, young man. And so I did, and I came out to Los Angeles with nothing but the Yiddish word is chutzpah, a lot of chutzpah, yeah. because I just didn't really think it through in terms of how ridiculous it was for me to attempt to break into an industry where I had never written a script before. I had written scripts for commercials, but those were 30-second, 60-second scripts. And there I was in Los Angeles, not knowing anybody, I had $750 to my name. And the top-rated show at that time was All in the Family. Mm-hmm. And there was a picture on the cover of Time magazine of Norman Lear, who was the executive producer and the showrunner and the creator of All in the Family. Again, you have to remember, I was a 25, 26-year-old kid who really didn't know very much. And sometimes being young and stupid is an advantage, because you don't know how ridiculous it is to do what you're doing, so you just do it. I picked up the phone and I called Norman Lear, and oh, wow. ultimately I got through to him, and I said that I was from New York and I was a writer and I had great ideas for his show, and I'd like to come in and pitch a story to him because I really got it. I understood the characters. Mm-hmm. And he must have been in a very forgiving and giving mood, because he said, okay, when do you want to come in? And we agreed that I would come in at 10 o'clock the next morning. Mm-hmm. I hung up the phone, and it quickly occurred to me that I didn't have a single idea for the show. It was all a bluff. But I stayed up until about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I showed up at 10 o'clock the next morning at his office. And I had 5 ideas that I thought were pretty good. And I pitched him the first one that I had. And he bought it in the room. And that was the beginning. That was how it started.
Wow. So I saw that your first writing job was on Ellery Queen in 1975.
Yeah, that was the first writing gig that I had that was produced. Mm-hmm. And that was a one-hour mystery show that was at Universal. Back in the day, if you were good and if you, you know, you got your work done on time and it was professionally delivered, you could make a pretty good career, pretty good living out of being a freelance writer. And Universal was at that time producing more one-hour dramas than any other studio in town. Mm-hmm. So there was this new show called Ellery Queen, which was kind of an Agatha Christie type of whodunit. Mm-hmm. And Peter Fisher, the executive producer, said to all the freelance writers, we all met in this huge room and we watched the pilot. He said, you don't have to come up with a full story. All you have to do is come up with an impossible crime and a solution to it, and we'll work with you to create the story. So I went off and I thought, and I wanted to do what is traditionally known as the locked room murder. Mm-hmm. So the setup was a guy gets into an executive elevator. He's the only one that can use the elevator. He's the chairman of the board of a huge corporation. He gets in on the lobby level and he goes up to the 12th or 14th or 15th floor, doesn't make any stops along the way. And when the elevator door is open, he's found shot to death. How did that happen? Now that's pretty intriguing. And usually most people think, well, the killer was on the roof and he climbed through the trap door, but that wasn't the answer. And after I allowed Peter Fisher to exhaust a lot of possibilities, I said that what happened was the killer, who had studied electrical engineering in college, went down to the basement and he reversed the wires on the elevator so that when the victim pressed the top floor of the penthouse, instead of going up, it went down to the basement. The doors opened. The killer was waiting there with a revolver, shot him to death, then put the wires back in the original position and pressed the penthouse, and the elevator went up to the penthouse without stopping anywhere. So as far as everybody was concerned, it looked like the elevator had just gone up to the 12th floor, had not made any stops. No one realized it had first gone down to the basement. Anyway, I got the gig as a result of that. And then Peter worked with me to create a story.
Well, so your first thing that you wrote with All in the Family, so that was a comedy, but, and then you switched to like writing a mystery.
Yeah. I started writing more and more comedies based on All in the Family, but back then comedy was very, very tame with the exception of All in the Family. It did not push the envelope of social sensibilities. And frankly, most of it was just set up joke, set up punchline. Mm-hmm. And I just got tired of that. And mm-hmm. I really wanted to write features. And mm-hmm. I wanted to write things that had more gravitas to them. And I switched over to drama. Mm-hmm. And I started doing a lot of mysteries. Then I started doing what were considered the softer dramas, more family-oriented dramas, more character-driven. Then I went back to mysteries because mysteries were changing. The whole scope of television was changing. And that happened in the early 80s. And that was a result of a man by the name, he too has unfortunately passed away, named Stephen Bochco, who created a show called it was a cop show, and it was really the first show of its kind that had an ensemble cast, and it also had an arcing series story, so that mm-hmm. a story could begin in episode one, and you could carry that story with all of these multiple characters all the way through to the end. It was like painting a giant mural rather than a postage stamp picture. And it just fascinated me. And that's what I got more and more involved with.
Mm-hmm. So
Hill Street Blues was the show.
Okay. So can you tell me how you moved from being a writer to becoming like a showrunner and then like producing, and like, how did you make those switches?
Well, you know, television is different than features. Okay. Historically, it's different. Mm-hmm. And usually the reason for the differences is a very practical one. In features, the person that pretty much has creative control is the director.
Mm-hmm.
It's and it still is that way. A film by Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the director is directing a one-time only story. And he or she has the privilege and the power to cast it, to edit it, to figure out the look of the show, the palette, if you will, of the show, the colors, all of that.
Yeah.
Television, as it's metamorphosized, has become much more serialized in that now stories begin on the first episode, your pilot episode or your opening episode of the season, and you carry them through to the end of the season. And sometimes you carry them through multiple seasons. Mm-hmm. Well, the writer is the one that has the most power because he or she has control of what the story is going to be at the very beginning of the season, before episodes are produced. Mm-hmm. We all sit in a writer's room and we arc out the series. We arc out the season. We try to figure out what our hero or heroine or protagonist or antagonist is going to be doing throughout the 9 or 10 or 12 or 15 episodes. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he or she is elevated to producer because we have a much more overall look of what the show is, not what the episode necessarily is, but what the show is. As I often tell the writers that I've worked with, you're not writing an episode, you're writing a series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a series is a cinematic novel. It's the protagonist, the antagonist. And essentially your primary conflict. And then you carry that through to the I chose producer and then finally a showrunner because it offered me the most control. It offered me the ability to do the kinds of stories that I wanted to do the seasons that I wanted to do, to cast in the way that I wanted to cast. I was casting in a diversified way long before it became part of our cultural edict, which it is now. I once cast, it was a crime show that I was doing, and it was about a family, and it was about a very ambitious attorney who winds up dealing with the wrong people, really out of arrogance, because everything that he had touched had turned to gold. And ultimately, he gets caught, and he's given a choice of becoming a federal witness and going into witness protection or serving time, and he decides to become a federal witness. And that involved his wife and his teenage daughter. And I cast that entire family black. Mm-hmm. And it had nothing to do with race. It had nothing to do with anything that was a cultural prerogative of the time. It just was more interesting to me.
Yeah.
And so I had the power to do it, and I did it. I wrote and produced a show where there was a woman that she lived in the Midwest. She came to Los Angeles in search of her teenage daughter who was a runaway living on the streets. Now that's a bona fide good story. And the runaway witnesses a murder, and then she becomes endangered, and et cetera, et cetera. But I decided that the mother should have a disability, which makes it even more difficult for her. So she's deaf. She's mm-hmm. profoundly deaf. And her role was played by Phyllis Frelich, who won a Tony on Broadway for her role in the play Children of a Lesser God. And I got to do these things that I'm proud of because I was in a position of authority.
Yeah.
That's a very long answer to your short question.
So, well, talking about producing, I read that you began your own production company. And how did that kind of change your role as a manager?
Yeah, at that time I was doing movies for television, and I was working for one of the more prolific movie for television companies. And I got to be pretty good at it. And as a matter of fact, I learned from one of the partners in that company, the art of pitching, because I would go to him in pitch meetings where he would sell concepts to the movie for television division of networks, NBC, CBS, ABC, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. And as I said, I was a born show off, a born actor. And I really enjoyed pitching. It made me nervous. And there were times when I truly dropped the ball. But over time, I got to be better and better and better at it. And I had the great fortune of knowing some people in New York who were in a sports marketing business, and they were quite successful at it. And they wanted to get into TV production, into features. And they were willing to open up an office in Los Angeles. And so I made a deal with them. They essentially put up the money. I put up the creativity and the knowledge of people out here with whom I had done business. And we had offices or an office in Century City, which is a very prestigious place in Los Angeles. And I was fairly successful. We were ultimately absorbed by a much larger company and got a rather large payoff. But I became tired of being just an executive and dealing with the bureaucracy and the politics of being an executive.
Yeah,
I wanted to produce. I wanted to write. I wanted to create. Mm-hmm. So I went back into that business as a producer on a television show.
Mm-hmm. So I see that you also served on the board of directors at the Writers Guild of America. You also served in the Writers Education Committee. So right. What did you really do there? And what is the Writers Guild of America, for those who don't know?
The Writers Guild of America, in its basic definition, is a guild or a union.
Yeah.
And it protects writers. And it began, I think, about 100 years ago now, and for screenwriters, because there was no such thing as a television business then. But as a result of the Writers Guild, there are now minimums that writers get for writing scripts, whether it be a feature script or a television script. It really depends. If it's features, it depends on the budget of the film. If the film is a low budget movie, then there's a certain fee that you're guaranteed to get for writing a script. If it's a mid-range feature, then the fee is higher. And if it's a big budget feature, you know, a $100 million feature, then obviously you're going to get a lot more money. It also protects you in terms of credits. It protects you in terms of residuals. It also now offers a blue plate gold standard medical plan, medical insurance that's, I think, second to none in the nation. And it has a very generous fund for retirement, your retirement fund. You know, I collect a very nice amount of money from my Writers Guild pension. And I've also taken advantage several times of my medical insurance through the Writers Guild. Mm-hmm. It costs money to join. Obviously, the initiation is quite high now, and it costs monthly dues, but you get it back over and over and over again. I am a very, very strong proponent of the Writers Guild.
Mm-hmm. So recently I've gotten into documentaries, and I saw that you did narration on some. So could you tell me what is it like in the behind the scenes of a documentary, and what's different between a documentary and something fictional?
Well, a documentary, unlike a scripted entity, whether it be a 2-hour movie or an extended television show, with something that's scripted, you pretty much know what you're going to get. You're following a script.
Yeah.
And there are scenes, and there are locations, and there are characters, and there's casting, and you know what you have. Yes, things obviously change in the course of production, but it starts out being on paper.
Yeah.
With a documentary, you have a concept. Let's say that right now the concept is about the effects that that the Ukrainian war is having on young children living in an area that's close to Poland, close to the border. What is this horrific event that's going on now? Is it really in a palpable way changing the lives of these children? Mm-hmm. Children who should be living at this point in time in their lives a rather innocent existence. Yeah. So that's your concept. That's what you start out with. And you have certain people that you're going to be interviewing, and you have certain areas that you're going to be shooting in, whether you need to get licenses or visas or permission. That's all the stuff that has to get done. And then you have all of that. And you go to that, in this case, this horrible, horrible part of the universe. Mm-hmm. And you start shooting film, not shooting weapons. And you shoot and you shoot and you interview and you interview and you talk to people and you see things, some of which you've expected to see, the carnage, the destruction, the buildings that are blown apart. Mm-hmm. But some of it you didn't expect. Yeah. You didn't expect the attitudes of these children. You didn't expect how their relationship with their parents or their friends is going to change. You didn't expect to see the wounds, the psychological wounds that you know are only going to get worse and worse and worse as they develop into adulthood, and are going to stay with them psychologically for the rest of their lives in various PTSD scenarios. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when it's all over, you may have 8-9 hours of film, thousands of feet of film.
Yeah.
And then you sit down and you have to go through it all. And it's very tedious, very time consuming, very demanding. But out of that begins to fashion the story that you're going to tell, the specificity of the story that you're going to tell, its beginning, its middle, and where you're going to end. But you don't really know that until you see what you've got. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, that's the primary difference.
Yeah. Did you enjoy your time working on documentaries?
Well, yeah, I never shot a documentary. I never filmed a documentary. There are other professors at USC that have done wonderful documentaries. Ted Braun, Braun, is one. He did a very well-received documentary on Darfur. And one of my students, one of my MFA students, did a documentary that she was part of a group of people that did a documentary that won an Oscar, won an Academy Award. And that was shot in these very poor villages in India. And the subject matter was that young women that were entering puberty and starting to go through puberty and their menstrual cycles were totally ignorant of what was happening to their bodies and didn't have sanitary napkins of any kind. And this was about teaching these young women, A, what was going on, B, not to be ashamed of what was going on, and C, that there is a whole industry devoted to making this process easier for you.
Yeah.
So I've been tangentially around people who have done those documentaries. I was just doing voiceovers because that's been another part of my career. I've recorded five books on tape for Time Warner and commercials and a few documentaries as well.
So I understand that. So you have spent most of your career in California. Do you think it was easier because you lived there? Like your career came about quicker? And do you think it's even possible to pursue a career in film if you don't live in America?
Well, I think it's possible to pursue a career in just about anything if you have the will. Mm-hmm. I think so much of success is not simply talent, but it's tenacity. Mm-hmm. It's stubborn drive. It's the kind of will that says, I will not give up. And coupled with that is a certain amount of ingenuity, of guile, of inspiration to figure out a game plan for yourself. Can you do it in places outside the United States? Yes, of course you can. There's a thriving film industry in Europe now. There's a thriving film industry in Israel. There are film industries in India and in Latin America. That said, the hub of the wheel is still Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It just is.
Yeah.
Most of the decisions that are made and sometimes affect other parts of the world are initiated here in LA. This is the power base. This is historically where it became now a multi-billion dollar industry. Mm-hmm. I would say to any young person, particularly if he or she is not hampered by other conditions, raising a family, having a partner that just doesn't want to move. Mm-hmm. But if you're willing to move, then come out here and do it here. This is where it's easier to network. Will you excuse me for a minute? I've got to open the door for my dog. She's
going
to drive me crazy as she is right now. Don't go away. I'll be right back. All right. I'll open the door for you. Oh, calm down. Relax. Okay. Hold on. I'm back.
Okay.
Are you able to see me?
I can see you. I can see you. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, you know, Liam, I'm assuming that you're on a pathway now that's directed toward perhaps doing documentaries or feature films or television, but some form of storytelling. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
All right. And how old are you?
I'm 17.
Okay. You are obviously, you may not feel young, but you are very young.
Yes.
Very, very yeah. young. You're still a teenager. God help you, but you are. And what you're pursuing may seem overwhelming to you. And that's appropriate. It should feel that way because there's so much that's out there, so very much. And you can't help but asking yourself, am I worthy? Do I have what it takes? Can I do this? Because the fact of the matter is, you're one of quite literally millions
yeah.
of people who want the same thing. Right now, I am currently on sabbatical, but I am extremely busy because I am working for two private schools, in both of which are situated in Beijing, China.
Wow.
And I am teaching Chinese students who are, most of whom are either seniors in high school or somewhere in their undergraduate career in colleges throughout China. They're all in various provinces of China mm-hmm. and everything is done virtually. And they, almost to a person, there are exceptions, but almost to a person, they want to come to the United States.
Yeah.
And they want to get into a graduate film program here. And part of what I do is to prepare them for it. I'm sort of like a tutor. I both teach them screenplay writing, but I also work on their portfolios with mm-hmm. them.
Yeah.
And they are very energetic. They are very, very nice people. And I've had a wonderful experience with all of them. One of them recently was accepted to USC,
wow.
the production division of the mm-hmm. School of Cinematic Arts, in the master's program. She's an extremely talented young woman and she deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I say to them and what I'm saying to you personally now, there is nothing out of your reach. If you want it badly enough, if you're willing to work really, really hard, and if you're sensible about it, if you're not arrogant, and if you're not stupidly stubborn, but you're willing to see it as a business, as a practicum, and as something that can be achieved, if you're willing to take the hits, and you will, and everybody does. I mean, I've had some very, very high points in my career, and I've had some very low ones as well. I've been out of work for an extended period of time. I had two small children at that time. I thought I was going to lose my house. My wife and I had a couple of $100 left in our checking account.
Wow.
I mean, really difficult times.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I persevered. Mm-hmm. Yet, I think it's something that I both learned and it's somehow factored into my DNA. I had the tenacity to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, I'm just going to go on a little bit more about this. Hopefully it'll have some
some
worthwhile purpose for you or for the people that listen to this. But I was reading as recently as this morning about a man by the name of Glenn Cunningham. Glenn Cunningham, when he was, I think, 7 years old, he and his older brother, who was 13, their chore was to light this kerosene stove to keep their very small house warm in the winter. This was somewhere in the Midwest. And one day, either he or his brother, instead of putting kerosene in the stove, put gasoline in the stove.
Wow.
The stove exploded. And his brother was killed. And Cunningham, Glenn Cunningham, was severely burned. Burned to the point of where the doctors wanted to amputate both of his legs because they thought the gangrene would set in and septicemia would set in and it would kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so distraught about losing his legs that he begged his mother to beg the doctors not to do it. And they did not.
Mm-hmm.
But they said that he would never walk. He would be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Well, Glenn Cunningham not only learned to walk, he learned to run. He won a silver medal in the Olympics, the 1933 or 36 Olympics. And he is regarded by most as one of the best, if not the all-time best, middle mile runners in history. And this was a boy that was supposed to never walk.
Mm-hmm.
And how did he do it? He certainly didn't do it because he had extraordinarily powerful legs or the capacity to breathe under great physical duress. He did it because he chose to do it and he was willing to do the work to achieve it. And he came within 4 seconds of breaking the 4-minute mile. And his personal best, which was a little over 4 minutes, lasted for over 3 years before it was broken by somebody else.
Wow.
So, it's hard. Life is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And no one is put on earth with a patent for easy living, in spite of what you may think. And everybody has something, and some people have more than their share.
Mm-hmm.
My son, who's now a man, was born profoundly deaf. So I not only lived with a disability, but I was the parent of a child with a disability. And I'll tell you something, being the parent of a child with a disability is a lot more painful than having it yourself. But he's doing okay. He works for Amazon and he's in robotics and they send him off to a special school to learn more. And life is not for the faint of heart. And this business is not for the faint of heart. But you can absolutely 100% achieve. And I'm living proof of that.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, you're the president of a school for hearing impaired children. You're also on the board of co-chaired Media Access, which helps people with physical disabilities get into the entertainment business. And what does this mean to you?
Well, once again, the Oralingua school, I'm no longer involved with either one of these organizations, but I was for many years.
Yes.
Yeah. I became involved with Oralingua because of my son.
Yeah.
And I became very much involved with the deaf community because of my son. That was a primary reason why I wrote that episode that I told you about. The deaf mother that comes to LA looking for her runaway child. I wanted to give a deaf actor an opportunity to be in a top-rated television show. And I've done that twice. And my involvement with Media Access was the same reason. I grew up at a time where there was no handicap access. There was no handicap parking. There was no mandate to have a ramp. so that a person in a wheelchair could get into a building. There were buildings. I remember going to Paramount, and you know, a lot of the buildings were very old. They were built in the 20s.
Yeah.
And some of the offices I had to go to were usually these buildings had three floors. We're on the third floor. Mm-hmm. And there was no elevator. You had to walk the stairs. And I could do that. I was able to do that. But if I had been in a wheelchair, that was a meeting that I could not attend. That was the possibility of work that I didn't have a chance of.
Wow.
And when there was a show that I really wanted to run. Mm-hmm. It was called Sirens. And it was about three female rookie cops. And it had everything in it that I really liked. It had cop stories, and it also had very emotional stories because it was about three females existing in a traditional man's world. And I was competing with several other possible showrunners. Anyway, it came down to me and two others. And I had this final meeting, and there were 10 executives in the room. And finally, one of them, excuse me, one of them said what my guess is everybody was thinking and had been thinking in other meetings. And he said, excuse me, but you know, you obviously have some physical limitations. Are you going to be able to get to the set if there's an emergency and somebody needs you in a hurry? And inwardly, I smiled. I wasn't insulted. I wasn't aghast mm-hmm. by it. I smiled because I had been waiting for so long for somebody to finally ask me if the emperor had clothes on. And I was ready. And I answered the question. And I think I must have answered it quite well because I got the gig. And I executive produced 22 episodes of that show. But, and by the way, in one of those episodes, which was about a homeless man who witnesses a murder, every character in every episode that I write sooner or later witnesses a murder. So you better be careful that I never write about you, Liam. Who knows what you'll see. Anyway, I cast as the homeless man, a deaf man who was very bitter about life because of his disability.
Wow. Have you seen the new movie, Coda?
Yes, I have.
That was a great movie, and it was all deaf actors.
Yeah, no, I've seen it. As a matter of fact, I've worked with Marley Matlin, who was the mom.
Wow.
And I'm very, very familiar with the deaf culture. There's a certain amount of, I think they're idiots, but there's a certain amount of resentment among the very strident deaf community that it made it look like a deaf person needed a hearing person to get by, which is ridiculous. I also worked with someone who directed the film that Marley Matlin won an Academy Award in Children of a Lesser God. I worked with her. So yes, I'm very familiar with that film and with the people who in some way, some tangential way, were associated with it.
Mm-hmm. So to move on, I'm not really sure if you know much about the admissions process into USC, but it's like a really selective school. With a 16% acceptance rate. Do you think you have any tips for high school students applying to the school?
Are you talking about the USC in general or the School of Cinematic Arts?
I think in general.
Well, you know, it's a school that strives to be among the top tier universities in the country or even in the world. Mm-hmm. And the USC School of Cinematic Arts is, I think, still rated number one in the world. Yeah. So obviously a GPA is very important. But I think also what's very important is to appear to be an interested person and an interesting person. And by that, to have been involved in other things. What else have you been doing with your life? You're an international student. You're currently living in Switzerland, correct?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's something. Mm-hmm. That's something that, I mean, you were born and raised in San Francisco, but you've lived in Israel. You now are part of a program, an educational program that's international. I would talk about that. I would talk about the things that you've done, the things that you've learned. They want to know about you. Who are you, Liam? What interests you? What can you bring to this university? What separates you from other very bright young men and women? And I think that that's important. Almost everyone who applies is going to have a high GPA.
Yeah.
Almost everyone. And they're going to probably have done quite well on their SATs. Are SATs still things that are considered? Because more and more they're being cast aside.
I think it can help you if you've done well.
Okay, so that's something that's taken into consideration. Mm-hmm. But I know that, I mean, I can only speak with familiarity for the School of Cinematic Arts and specifically the writing division.
And that's one like a master's program, right?
Well, and the undergraduate. I've been on the acceptance committee for both.
Wait, so sorry. So does a high school student apply to the School of Cinematic Arts?
Yes.
Okay.
So you would apply to USC, but you're really applying to the School of Cinematic Arts, and you also want to say what your preference is, because there are six divisions in the School of Cinematic Arts. Is it writing? Is it production? Is it animation? Is it interactive? Is it the Stark School? I mean, there are, you know, you'd have to do a little bit of research. But for the writing division, which is the admissions committee that I've been on for both MFA and BFA, one of the most important parts of the admissions program or exam, I should say, is the biographical statement. Who are you? And it's not just about the events that have happened in your life. It's how have these events affected you? Mm-hmm. How have they shaped you? And what is your voice? How do you tell a story? Are you, even if it's a tragic story, even if it's about the death of a parent, can you, or the loss of someone or something that was very valuable, can you tell it in a way that's interesting? I've read biographical statements that were written in the third person. So instead of saying I, they were talking about Liam. Liam didn't think he could get out of bed that morning. It was just overwhelming to him, the pain, the desolation, the loneliness. But somehow he managed. Somehow he found a way. And in that process, he also learned where his strength was. See, that's telling a story in a way that's different than, and this happened to me, and this happened to me, and then I went through a depression. Some people have told stories that were pretty harrowing, but they've told it with humor. And you wind up, if not laughing at a moment, certainly smiling. And that just goes to his or her creativity.
Mm-hmm.
It's about who are you?
Yeah.
And what at this point do you want? And what are you willing to learn? I think that life, and others have said this, life is a giant classroom. If you're not willing to learn, then you're throwing away many, many precious years. Muhammad Ali, great prize fighter and really great human being, said, If you feel the same way at 50 that you did when you were 20, then you've wasted 30 years of your life. So I think part of that is allowing the reader to understand that you, as an applicant, understand that you have miles to go before you sleep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And I feel like most schools are like that. They don't want to know really what you've done, but like why and how that's changed you.
Right.
Yeah. So as a professor of screenwriting, we have to know, what's your best tip for screenwriters to improve their work?
Well, it's like asking me, what's the purpose of life?
Or a better question would be, what's the most common mistake that you see young screenwriters make?
I think the most there are a lot of common mistakes. One is that they overwrite, mm-hmm. and they feel that they need to explain everything. So you have a lot of scenes that are bloated, and I use that word with intent, bloated with all kinds of exposition, expository dialogue. Well, you remember that when we were young and we would go for rides and we would drive through the countryside, we would talk about, I mean, characters don't talk like that. Yeah. If in fact it's a long-term friendship, they already know this, so they shorthand it. Remember mm-hmm. that time we saw that pumpkin patch and we pulled over and all you wanted to talk about was what you were going to do on your date Saturday night? Yeah, I remember that. So what's your point? Well, my point is that you missed the pumpkin patch because you were so far in the fucking future that you weren't thinking about now. Yeah, and your point? My point is that you're still there. Yeah. Start being in the now.
Okay.
See the difference?
Yeah, yeah.
Because now I'm doing dialogue about two people who know each other, who have a history with each other.
Mm-hmm.
The other common mistake is that they think that storytelling is simply about plot. He did this, she did that, they did something else.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than beginning with the character. Who is this person? What happened to him or her before the film started? Why is he or she the way he or she is at this point in his or her life? Then he or she is confronted with conflict, because mm-hmm. that's what stories are about. Every scene needs to have conflict in it. Based on who this person is, based on what has shaped this person's life up to present, why is he choosing or she choosing to do this when faced with that conflict? Because what he or she chooses to do creates action, and that action creates a scene. And if you couple those scenes together, you have a story. So it starts with the character.
Yeah.
Yes, there is an inciting incident, something that gets the ball rolling. There's an explosion. There's a serious illness. There's a big college game coming up, something. Mm-hmm. But then after that, it's what do people choose to do as a result of who they are and what they are presented with. Mm-hmm. And the third thing I would say is you're going to get a lot of rules, regardless of what subject you're studying, the do's and don'ts. Yeah. Oftentimes young writers will say, okay, I'm finished, assuming that they're writing a feature script, which has a traditional 3-act structure. Okay, I'm through with the first act. What page should I be on? Don't worry about that. Don't worry about it. Because in point of fact, all of the rules you're getting and all of the rules you will ever get can be broken. They can all be broken. They can all be tossed away.
Yeah.
Except one irrevocable rule that can never, ever, ever be broken. And that rule is simply don't bore the audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Tell a damn good story.
I think that's the rule for all entertainment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Entertain.
Yeah.
That's what they're paying their money for.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, I mean, this is when you get into more advanced work. But in a feature, I believe in the really good features. There's always, but sometimes there's more than one, what I call the money scene. It's what people pay money to see.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the film On the Waterfront?
I am not.
Are you familiar with the film? I'm trying to think of Chinatown. Are you familiar with Chinatown?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. In Chinatown, there is that scene between Jake Gittes and Evelyn, where she says, where he slaps her and he says, "Who the hell are you?" Or yeah. "Who the hell is she?" "She's my daughter." Boom. "She's my sister." Boom. "She's my daughter, my sister, my daughter, my sister. She's yeah. both my daughter and my sister." And then there's a moment where he gets it and she says, "Are you getting it now? Or is this too tough for you to understand?" That's the money scene, because what that scene is about, what the subtext of that scene is about, it's not simply about incest and the horrors of incest. What it's really about and what Chinatown thematically is about is that if you're rich enough and if you're powerful enough, you can do just about anything mm-hmm. and get away with it.
Yeah,
because ultimately, that's how corrupt power is.
Mm-hmm.
That's your money scene.
Yeah. So before we end, I want to ask one question that I've never asked before. And I want your totally unbiased opinion as a professional screenwriter. But do you think screenwriters get enough credit? Can there even be a movie without a screenwriter?
I do not think that screenwriters get enough credit. And I think that unless you are elevated to a certain position where sometimes you, and it's very, very rare, you will have your name above the title. It's almost all, I'm talking about features now, yeah. not about television. There was a famous screenwriter, brilliant and just a genius, Paddy Chayefsky. He had his name above the title. Neil Simon, he had his name above the title. Woody Allen, but then again, he's an auteur. He directs as well starred in a lot. Whether you liked his work or didn't like his work. And why am I blanking? He did Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction.
No, Tarantino.
Tarantino.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino. But then again, he's a director and he's an actor.
Yeah.
Just as a writer. No, most of them, even the really, really fine ones, Steven Zalian, other writers like that who have written brilliant work.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they're paid an extraordinary amount of money. I mean, they can easily get $1 million a script.
Yeah.
But do they get, if Steven Zalian is writing a film that Spielberg is directing, whose name gets above the title?
Yeah.
Spielberg,
yeah.
Not that Spielberg doesn't deserve it, because he is a remarkable, I think he's one of the greatest directors ever. If you look at the volume of his work, where he started out in television, movies, in movies for TV, and then ultimately did something that I think is one of the finest films ever made, Schindler's List.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and if you compare that to Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. You just see the breadth of what he's capable of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they don't. But, you know, Liam, I guess I'm just at a certain place in time in my life where I fought a lot of battles, most of which were driven by ego. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It's all a narcissistic quest for the most part. What really matters is, did I do a good job? Did my work somehow affect even minutely the world in a way that made it a little bit better? Mm-hmm. Every class that I teach, every single class, and I've been doing this for the 18 years I've been teaching.
Yeah.
On the first day of class, whether it's MFA or BFA, whether it's spring or fall or summer, I say to my students, I will never dictate what you must write. I will offer opinions. I will make suggestions. I will try to explain why I think one thing is better than another. But at the end of the day, it's up to you. It's your script.
Yeah.
Your name is on the title page, not mine. I will never, ever dictate anything, except this one time. This one time, I will ask you to write this one sentence exactly as I dictated. And that sentence is, bring honor to the work.
Mm-hmm.
Bring honor to the work. Because in the end, that's all that you have. Your integrity, your honor, your willingness to go the extra mile, to do the extra work, to make it better so that you can elevate the craft, and in that process, elevate yourself.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming today.
You're very welcome. Liam, if things come, you're only 17, you've got time, but if you want to reach out to me again, you certainly know how to do it. If you want to WhatsApp me, I will give you my phone number and you can do that.
Sure. Thank you.
Don't be shy. Do you want my cell phone?
I will, but tell me it after I stop recording.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I forgot. There are others that are going to be privy to this.
So thank you.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for coming, David. If anyone wants to know more about David and his work, check out his IMDb page or his biography on the USC website. Thank you for listening to the Student Screenwriting Podcast.